Well, what do you think is the most important issue facing us as a nation or a society? My guess is that you each have one or perhaps a few issues that you feel are most crucial today. It might be jobs, housing foreclosures, Wall Street, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, climate change, healthcare, education, perhaps issues of gender or race. I've said for years that if every one of us dropped our specific issue for a year and instead pooled our energies to fight and win the battle to get big money out of politics, that would be the single most effective thing we could do to win on every other issue. It's clear to me all the time that what we in the U.S. need is what I call a real democracy trifecta. Campaign finance reform, that's public financing with free TV ads, media reform, and election reform. Those three as a foundation for everything else we want that involves politics and government. I believe achieving that populist agenda will be necessary before we can expect real improvement on any of our specific issues. And if you think things were bad, you know they've gotten worse. One can now realistically ask, has government of, by, and for the people perished from the United States? January 21st, a divided Supreme Court reversed precedent and law, voting 5-4 in Citizens United versus Federal Elections Commission to remove all limits on corporate contributions to political campaigns. We'll discuss that decision in the context of money in politics, as well as looking at potential outcomes and possible remedies. On the phone with me are Bob Edgar, previously a congressman and president of Claremont School of Theology, and now president and CEO of Common Cause, and Scott Nelson, an attorney with Public Citizen, who represented key sponsors of McCain-Feingold before the Supreme Court. First, a bit about Common Cause, which I think is an interesting institution in America. John Gardner, a Republican, came to Washington, D.C. to serve as the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare under Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, which tells you a little bit about how much things have changed over the last 45 years. He later became chair of the National Urban Coalition, a group advocating for poor, minority, and working-class residents in urban areas. During his time in the nation's capital, Gardner observed, quote, "Everybody's organized but the people." So in August 1970, he established Common Cause to represent citizens' interests in Washington and to hold elected leaders accountable. Today, the organization has nearly 400,000 members and supporters and 36 state organizations. Public Citizen, organization with Scott Nelson is affiliated, is a national, nonprofit consumer advocacy organization founded in 1971 to represent consumer interests in Congress, the executive branch, and the courts. Bob Edgar is the president and CEO of Common Cause, and before coming to Common Cause, Edgar served 12 years in Congress from the state of Pennsylvania, 10 years as president of Claremont School of Theology, and 7 years as the general secretary of the National Council of Churches of Christ, the leading ecumenical organization in North America. Welcome, Bob Edgar.
To be with you.
Thank you. And Scott Nelson is an attorney at the Public Citizen Litigation Group in Washington, D.C., where he has practiced since August 2001. After graduating with honors from Harvard College, he attended Harvard Law and was elected president of the Harvard Law Review in 1983. I believe that's a distinction he shares with Barack Obama. He then served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Byron White, and Nelson has represented key congressional sponsors of McCain-Feingold, as I said, before the Supreme Court in Citizens United versus FEC. Welcome, Scott Nelson.
Hi. Thank you.
Very good. Now, what I'd like to do, this hour is going to be devoted to money and politics and the specific ruling that just went down and possible impacts and hopeful remedies. But I'd like to just start with an opening comment from each of you about the court's decision, its meaning, and its impact. Bob, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I'm pleased to be on your show and also pleased to be on it with Public Citizen, who's a partner and colleague and collaborative partner with Common Cause and Public Campaign and a number of other organizations for good government and reform. This past week, the Supreme Court brought down a decision which I call the Super Bowl of bad decisions. It sets back public financing and financing reform efforts for more than 100 years, and I think it was based on the wrong premise. It was only a 5-4 vote, very close, but those who voted in the majority think that corporations and labor unions don't have voice. They believe that corporations are persons and ought to be treated under the free speech provisions of our Constitution. I think that's just wrong. Corporations have plenty of voice. Anyone who has followed the crisis in housing, investments, banking, any of the debate on health care, know that corporations have already made big inroads in holding House and Senate members to positions that aren't in the public interest, they're in the special interest. Corporations have tainted much of the debate in Washington for years, and the Supreme Court's decision simply gives them more power, more opportunity to weigh in elections. And one of the nuances of the decision is what I call the fear factor. I served in Congress, and one of the corporations in my district was Boeing Vertol, that made the Boeing company made helicopters for the military, something called the Chinook helicopter. I can imagine them now walking into a congressman or senator's office from Pennsylvania and saying, you know, I didn't like the way you voted on this issue or that issue, and while we're not putting any money against you yet, we've got a pocket full of money. We can go right into our treasury and plow that into radio and television commercials against you. $4, $5, $6, $7, $8 million just in one swoop. I think it's going to be a disastrous decision. And Common Cause, working with Public Citizen and Public Campaign, we think we have some answers to how to turn this decision around. But it is the Super Bowl of bad decisions.
Thank you. That was Bob Edgar, the president and CEO of Common Cause. And now Scott Nelson, one of the attorneys with Public Citizen.
Well, I agree with everything that Bob has just said. I want to talk a little bit maybe more specifically about exactly what the Supreme Court held and exactly what pre-existing restrictions on corporate activity it struck down. The early part of the 1900s, Congress passed a law called the Tillman Act that said corporations could not contribute money to candidates in federal elections. And in the 1940s, in the Taft-Hartley Act, Congress expanded that to provide that corporations can't make any of their own expenditures to support or oppose candidates in federal elections. And those restrictions on corporate activity were included again when Congress in the early 1970s passed the Federal Election Campaign Act. But they got watered down a little bit because the courts interpreted political expenditures to be pretty much limited to advertisements that contained what were referred to as magic words, a very limited number of terms that expressly said vote for or vote against Bob Smith. And political advertisers in the decades that followed became adept in using ads to convey electoral messages without using those particular magic words. So in the what's referred to as the McCain-Feingold Act or the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, Congress went one step further, and it said corporations would be prohibited from running broadcast ads in the periods immediately before elections that mentioned federal candidates. And the Supreme Court upheld that, but put a little bit of a gloss on it to say that they had to convey clear electoral messages. Well, that was the state of the law up until last week, that corporations were prohibited from either spending money on ads or other activities that directly said vote for or against federal candidates or that conveyed that unmistakable message. What the court held this past week is that under the majority's view of the First Amendment, a corporation has an unlimited First Amendment right to spend as much of its money as it wants on messages telling people whom to vote for. And that can include broadcast advertising, it can include direct mail, it can include phone banks, it can include hiring people to go up and down the streets knocking on doors. As of today, or as of Thursday, corporations will have the ability in federal elections and in state elections, since states also are covered by the First Amendment, to make unlimited expenditures on election campaigns.
You both set it up well, I think. Bob, as you did, set up more the context, and you dealt more with the legal, Scott. And this is the way I'd like to see the hour go from here on. Let's take up a little more of the legal with you, Scott. Then, and Bob, feel free to chime in during that part of the conversation. Then look more at the context of money and politics. Bob, I'd expect you to take the lead there, and Scott, feel free to chime in. And finally, Bob has to leave us at about 45 after the hour, at which point Scott and I will finish up with more legal or remedies or whatever remains after that. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Sounds good.
Okay. So, Scott, on the legal, Citizens United versus FEC did not originally ask the broad question that the Supreme Court ruled on this week. Am I correct? And so tell us a little bit about that, because I think it does set sort of the narrative of how this decision emerges.
Yes, it's a funny case to be deciding that for-profit corporations have unlimited rights to engage in political advertising, because what it started out as was a case where a nonprofit organization, a very conservative group called Citizens United, wanted to get a ruling that a movie that it had created, a scathing documentary, if you will, about Hillary Clinton, wasn't covered by the law because it wasn't really a political advertisement, or the means through which Citizens United was going to be broadcasting it didn't qualify for coverage under the Campaign Reform Act, or because Citizens United should qualify for an exemption from the law that the court had previously recognized for nonprofit organizations that didn't take money from business corporations. And there, Citizens United said, well, we took a little bit of money from for-profit corporations, but it was so minimal that we should still be qualified for the exemption. So they were making some very narrow arguments that were really limited to the specific context in which they wanted to show their movie and to their type of organization, which is a nonprofit that accepted a very small amount of corporate funding.
Let me cut in for a second. So really, yeah, in terms of the narrow issues, part of it is a movie an ad was like one of the main things, and is this political advertising, and does that small amount of corporate money matter? That's what they came to the court with.
Right. Now, I mean, one of the things that I think moved the court in some ways was some of their arguments for a narrow exception weren't particularly plausible. For example, everybody who saw this movie, apparently even very conservative judges on the lower court and the conservative justices in the majority of the Supreme Court, didn't really buy that it was a documentary. What it was, in their view, was just a very extended, if you will, infomercial about why people should vote against Hillary Clinton. But even so, Citizens United was not originally coming in asking for sweeping changes in campaign finance law. But as it turned out, since they had taken some corporate money, the Supreme Court majority realized that one way to resolve the case, the very broadest possible way of resolving the case, would be to say, well, we don't need to even think about these narrow grounds. If all corporations, including for-profit corporations, have an unlimited right to use their money to engage in political advertising, that would also result in a win in this case for Citizens United. So the after the case was argued last spring on the narrow grounds that Citizens United had sought to advance, the court sat on it for a couple of months, and one can speculate that behind the scenes there may have been some jockeying around for possible ways to come up with a majority opinion. And what they finally did on the very last day of their term last year was issue an order saying, we would like this case to be re-argued on the question whether we should overrule a couple of previous precedents that had held that for-profit corporations could be limited from engaging in political spending. And so it was really the court that first brought into the case this extremely broad question, including the question of overruling the court's own precedent.
Let me ask you about that. As someone who, you know, doesn't pay attention to the court all the time, looks at it, you know, when there are certain big issues at play, how normal or irregular is this sort of thing where someone comes in with a narrow question and they're told, no, we'd like to rule on something more sweeping?
This is Bob Edgar. I think it's very unusual. Many conservatives complain about activist judges. This is an activist effort, as was just said by my colleague there. They didn't have to rule on such a broad range of issues. They were asked to rule on a very narrow set, and they themselves took the extraordinary effort on the last day of last year's session to call for this special session. And one can only imagine that the conservatives on the court, seeing the change in the 2008 election and seeing some of the marginalization of some of the activities of conservatives, really used this as an opportunity to open up the treasuries of the corporations and unions to spend directly for or against candidates. And it was really, I think, outrageous and very, very, very unusual.
And that's one of the reasons, by the way, another question I was going to ask, is that it seems to me from that moment on, people pretty much assumed the decision would come as it did. And one other thing about this is, in something I read, they mentioned the fact that Roberts, when he was in his confirmation hearings, really downplayed what he thought his role would be. He called himself sort of an umpire and that he would be seeking consensus. The conservatives have talked about the Warren Court as an activist court, and yet Earl Warren, appointed by a Republican, did actually seek consensus. And when he made, or his court made, some of its sweeping racial integration rulings, they did it with large majorities, and same with the privacy ruling on Roe v. Wade, large majorities or unanimous decisions. To make such a sweeping decision on a 5-4, what does that say? And I'll let either of you take that.
I think it's the umpire getting up to bat and hitting, trying to hit a home run.
Or throwing a beanball at the opponent's stars.
Yes. I think that's right. Well, I think we've outlined the fact that this is an activist issue. It was a narrow decision. It wasn't a consensus decision by the courts, but it limits the kind of response. And I'm pleased that you've got this hour of conversation, because the American public really has to wake up to the fact that money is corroding almost all the decisions that are being made in Washington. This will just add to that. And if we really want to address things like global warming and health care, public education, and the quality of life issues, or even the international issues, we need public officials who get themselves elected and don't feel like they have to spend 50, 60, 70% of their time raising money for the next election. And this is just going to marginalize those good government elected officials and put in play much more lobbying/money/corporate Wall Street intrusion into the public's square. And Common Cause and Public Citizen, Public Campaign, and others really need to work on some specific responses. I think first we need clear public education. Second, we need to look at corporate registration, which happens state by state, if there are any things we can do to marginalize this decision. We want to get shareholders involved in asking questions. Should their senior executives make political decisions now as to how to spend the corporate treasuries? We also need to look at whether or not state by state, region by region, corporations can be monitored and whether full transparency can take place. And finally, Common Cause and others have been very active in fair elections and public financing. We installed it in Arizona and Connecticut and Maine. We think that's a piece of the response. And right now, before the House and Senate, we've got a voluntary Fair Elections Now program introduced in the Senate by Senator Dick Durbin, introduced in the House by Congressman Larson. And we have more co-sponsors of that legislation, which would install a system voluntarily where candidates would give up special interest money, corporate money, and would simply raise $100 contributions in their congressional district or state, have it matched by $400 of public funds, not take any corporate or Wall Street money, and find a different way to elect people, what we call a voter-owned election as opposed to a corporate-owned election, which this decision will help install.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. What I'm going to do is shift a little from what I was planning to do, because I'm seeing now I only have you for another 20 minutes, Bob. I'll tell you what, Scott, we'll come back to some of the specifics in this, in the legal piece of this in the last 15, corporations as persons, money as speech, and whether or not this is a threat to the public welfare, after Bob leaves the call. But if you two will allow me, I'm going to take the mic for a couple of minutes here and lay out some of how I see the money and politics influencing things right now.
Go for it.
Okay. First of all, I recommend that everyone go to pbs.org/Moyers, where you can find an amazing archive. I didn't realize, but Bill Moyers has almost every show going back the journal for years, back to his great ideas and so on. And so that's just a wealth of information if you care about if you care about America, if you care about the world. But check out the interview from January 15th. This is not the past Fridays, but a week ago, in which he interviewed Thomas Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas. In it, Frank's, you know, they're looking at the first year of the Obama administration, and Frank says, you know, he feels that Obama and the Democrats basically, but Obama in the lead, and missed a great opportunity by not making clear over and over and over again to the American public that what they are trying to heal is the damage done by the previous administration. At the end of the conversation, Moyers asks him why he thinks Obama and most of the Democrats have been unwilling to make that case, and Frank's answer is, I'm afraid they don't want to offend their funders. And if that was the case before this decision, how much worse might it be now? We've seen it in, as you said, Bob, in healthcare, in the response to Wall Street, in climate and energy bills, just to name three, where you end up getting halfway measures that do not get to the root of problems or attempt to achieve true solutions. In his response to the Supreme Court decision, Ralph Nader wrote, perhaps Justice Kennedy didn't hear that the financial sector invested more than $5 billion in political influence purchasing in Washington over the past decade. $5 billion, with as many as 3,000 lobbyists winning deregulation and other policy decisions that led directly to the current financial collapse. And for that, I highly recommend another website. Go to wallstreetwatch.org and read Sold Out, How Wall Street and Washington Betrayed America. It links the money spent by the financial institutions with the deregulation that led to the catastrophic recession and crash that we all deal with now. The Center for Responsive Politics, again, I'm quoting Nader, reported that last year the U.S. Chamber of Commerce spent $144 million to influence Congress and state legislatures. And as we've seen, the Chamber of Commerce is no more that thing that's representing that mom-and-pop store down in Peoria. They are among the biggest climate change deniers, et cetera, et cetera. The Center also reported big lobbying expenditures by the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, $26 million in 2009. Drug companies like Pfizer, Amgen, and Eli Lilly poured tens of millions into federal lobbying in 2009. The health insurance industry trade group, America's Health Insurance Plans, spent several million. And as Nader says, no wonder single-payer health insurance, supported by the majority of people, doctors, and nurses, supported by the majorities, hasn't even been on the table in Congress. Now, I've often said we need public financing of campaigns, and some of the public reacts, they're not going to use my tax dollars for their damn campaigns. They're bad enough already. And I believe, and this is what you said, Bob, we need education. If people saw that the single best return on investment any company makes is to invest money in politicians, and some numbers from that report that Nader cited. The financial sector invested more than $5.1 billion. The entire financial sector, including finance, insurance, and real estate, drowned political candidates and campaign contributions, spending more than $1.7 billion from 98 to 2008. And reflecting the balance of power over the decade, about 55% went to Republicans, 45% to Democrats. Now that Democrats are in power, they're getting more than half of the financial sector's money in 2008 and more than half in 2009. The industry spent even more, $3.4 billion on officially registered lobbying of federal officials during the same period. Now, what I want you to remember, folks, when I said the return on investment, I'm emphasizing how much money they spent. But think about it. They spent $5 billion in political influence and $3 billion in lobbying. That's $8 billion. They've gotten at least $1 trillion in return for that. You've got to look at it. There's nothing they spend money on. No invention they make, no bright guy they hire, no innovation ever makes them as much money as buying political power. And let me just see if I have a little bit more here. That's what I want. And Bob, do you have any more to add to that? Because I think that's the lesson that people just sort of, if you say to them, well, we should do public financing and get, I mean, what I say is at that point, you not only own your representatives on election day, but you own them 365 days a year. And as we know, if you don't, they spend most of their time, not doing your work, but raising money for the next election.
Absolutely. I do have something to say, and since I'm a preacher and a politician, let me just say amen. I think you're absolutely right. We have to recognize that the system is broken. There is donor fatigue. They're being dunned by every elected official they can find for money. There's candidate fatigue, who's running 60-70% of the time trying to raise money. Common Cause did a study, which you can see on our website, called Legislating Under the Influence, and we discovered that in the healthcare debate, from the year 2000 to the year 2008, special interest groups in healthcare spent $3 billion hiring lobbyists and an additional $350 million giving money to candidates only on the committees and subcommittees of jurisdiction. The healthcare debate was corroded long before last year, and people look at the housing debate and the banking debate and the investment crisis. Now, go back to the 1990s where Democrats and Republicans took money from Wall Street to loosen the regulation, to allow unfettered profits to weigh in, and then the same talking heads are on television telling us now they're going to fix it, and yet we've seen with the bailout issues and the bonus issues that Wall Street and corporations still own a large part of the public square.
Let me do two things just before we return to the conversation. I'm going to give you the websites of both of their organizations and a few more, and I'm going to give you my email address now and when I finish this list and tell you email me and I'll give you this list. My email is temcnally@mac.com. So we have CommonCause.org, Citizen.org, PublicIntegrity.org, PublicCampaign.org, The Alliance for Democracy.org, Move to Amend. This is a group that has just come together. It's an alliance of people that are behind an amendment to take on this issue. Move to Amend.org, Free Speech for People, FreeSpeechForPeople.org, another group that has come together around this specific decision. And then, as I mentioned, WallStreetWatch.org does a good job of linking some of the money. And as I said, email me at temcnally@mac.com. If you're driving and you don't want to write these things down right now, then email me and I'll send you this list. So we've got you for about another 10 minutes, Bob. You were speaking of remedies. And so let people get a fuller feeling for what you think some of the remedies are.
Number one, we need massive public education while this issue is still hot. Number two, we need shareholders to put pressure on corporations to voluntarily not go along with spending corporate treasury on political campaigns. Number three, we need to install public financing, fix the presidential system and here we need to call on the Obama administration to work with McCain in revising, reforming, and updating the presidential public financing system, which worked for 5 elections and then stumbled in the last election because the system was broken. And then with that, they need to turn to something called Fair Elections Now. Ask your House or Senate member whether they're a co-sponsor of Fair Elections Now, which would install a voluntary public financing system similar to what happened in Connecticut in the 2008 election. After we put the former governor in jail for corruption, the legislature passed public financing, and in the 2008 election, 74% of the candidates running for state legislature used our public financing system. 81% of them got elected, took no special interest money, including a 24-year-old college student who qualified and received the funds, beat an incumbent, and now is in the state legislature in Connecticut. We have it in Maine. We have it in Arizona. We have it in cities like Portland and Albuquerque and Santa Fe. We need to spread that good virus not only across the country but into the House and Senate. And finally, let's make it a massive effort to get elected officials now to stand up and speak out about corporate and labor influences in elections. Average ordinary people need to own the elections. The Constitution was done for the people and by the people. It ought to be owned by the people. Democracy needs to be owned by average ordinary citizens and not dictated by who has the deepest pockets and the most corporate or labor money that they can throw against a candidate. Even at the presidential level, you know, if a candidate goes out and raises $500 million to run for president, there are rogue corporations that could walk in and put $1 billion up simply to recycle a presidential candidate that they dislike. Think of what happens in some of our medium to small states where candidates raise $5 or $10 million for the Senate race, and a corporation walks in and puts $25 million down simply to either unseat someone they don't like or to support someone that they do like.
Well, let me jump in on that. People are probably well aware that in a strategy that I thought was very destructive, ultimately, Obama laid out some broad principles and then threw it to the Senate to decide, which then meant that it came down to that finance committee to do the main deciding in the Senate. Max Baucus he's a senator from Montana. He gets 13% of his campaign funds from the state of Montana. So Max Baucus, when he is making those decisions on the finance committee about health care and about a lot of other issues, finance committee is a very good committee to be the chairman of, he is not representing the people of Montana who elected him. He gets 87% of his political contributions from outside the state from people who have business with the finance committee. Kent Conrad, also on the finance committee from a small state of Idaho, similar. And you just see this up and down. So we're talking about it getting worse. But I know some people have said, well, it can't get much worse, so don't worry about this decision. But, I mean, that kind of influence where almost all of their money is not from their constituents.
Yeah, I would add another thing. I got elected with Max Baucus back in 1974 as one of the Watergate babies. And Max, I can tell you, when he first came to the House of Representatives, was part of the Watergate baby class, part of the reform group that shut down the Vietnam War and started putting reforms in place. I think part of Max's problem is not only has he taken so much money from special interests, including the healthcare industry, but I think there's need to recycle elected officials periodically. I believe in long-term limits, not short-term limits where staff or special interests can control the outcome, but I don't think anyone should stay there 25, 30, 40 years. It ought to be a season in their life, and we ought to take a hard look at that, because if I was corrupted by anyone during my 12 years in office, I was corrupted by my friends, not my enemies. My enemies were out trying to get someone to defeat me. It was my friends who began to say, here are the issues we want you to support. And when you didn't support one of their issues, you suddenly became their friend who had betrayed them.
Right. So let me just say one other thing. This fair elections now that you've mentioned a couple of times that Durbin has put forward and that others have signed on with, what are the chances of that passing?
I think the chances are better this year than ever before, particularly in the House, not in the Senate because of the silly filibuster rules, but in the House. The most we ever had on public financing in terms of co-sponsors was about 50, 55, 60 co-sponsors. We now have about 130 House co-sponsors of fair elections now. More since Thursday when this decision came down, there are more House members looking at this, including Republicans, who believe that some alternative to the current system of fundraising has to be.
Because my question actually at the end of that, Bob, was going to be, if you are an incumbent and you have that seat and now you know that corporations can give everything, would you be cutting off your nose to spite your face to say, oh, I'm going to walk away from that. I'm going to actually do what the citizens deserve?
I think under normal circumstances that would be right, but I think the citizens have become very smart, and good government is good politics these days. I think one of the problems with Obama right now is that he has not spent enough time on his reform agenda, attacking some of the issues. He's done a good job on lobbyists, but he's got to connect lobbyists with money, and he's got a number of other reform issues that are there. I think people aren't supporting the Democratic Party or the Republican Party now. They want government to work. When I served in Congress, by the way, from 75 to 87, there wasn't one piece of legislation, good pieces of legislation, that was put in place only by the Democrats. We had Jake Javits in New York. We had Brooks in Massachusetts, Hines and Schweiker in Pennsylvania, and 100 Republicans who, once elected, sat down and we worked across party lines on issues of economic development, jobs, public education. That's all changed. The House and Senate have become so partisan that it's simply outrageous. And I think many of the elected officials are tired of raising money, and they're tired of the partisanship. That's why you see so many of them leaving public life. And we need to encourage our young people to step forward and run for public office. And then once elected, you're not serving your party. You're serving the public's need and the public interest, and not some special interest that's padding your election campaign with money.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about that in those old days, as I have said many times, there were Republicans like those folks that were actually statesmen, that actually saw the bigger picture. My problem with Obama's faith in bipartisanship is that it's nostalgic and naive at this moment. That while we need a return to it, I think that that's a longer term issue, that these things we're talking about, like public financing, will allow us. But in the current reality, and I know Common Cause is a nonpartisan organization, and Public Citizen is probably as well. But what I see is the public losing when he pursues bipartisanship as a higher goal than healthcare that works for all, etc.
I think that's right, and I think Thursday's decision by the Supreme Court, which is so tragic, is going to make the system worse, not better, unless average ordinary citizens stand up and demand of the White House and of the Congress ways to modify and change the perception. And you're going to talk in a few minutes
right
about corporations being persons. I think some corporations don't have a heart.
I think that's, well, I mean, it is their legal duty that their highest goal is return to shareholder, and that is not, that doesn't call for a heart. I'm going to let you go. I'm letting Bob Edgar go. He is the president and CEO of Common Cause. The website is commoncause.org. Thank you, Bob Edgar. Keep up the good work.
Great to be with you. Take care.
Thank you. And we will continue with Scott Nelson of Public Citizen. Scott Nelson is an attorney with Public Citizen, and he represented some of the sponsors of McCain-Feingold in the Supreme Court case, and he will be with us for the rest of the hour. Scott, we left you there on the sidelines for a few moments. A couple of questions I have is, a caller called in and asked just who it was that voted the way they voted.
Yes, the majority opinion was written by Justice Anthony Kennedy.
And Kennedy is sort of the swing vote nowadays?
Well, he's considered to be a swing vote on many issues. On this issue, I would not regard him as a swing vote. He has long been among those on the Supreme Court who has advocated using the First Amendment to scale back on campaign finance reform, and he had earlier joined opinions calling for the overruling of the opinions that were overruled Thursday.
Okay, so he nowadays often is the one that as he goes, so goes the court. But you're saying on this issue, one of the reasons, remember I said, that from the time that the court broadened the question, it appeared the decision was in. So Kennedy voted with the majority, and the rest were, let me see, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia.
That's correct.
And then in the dissent, John Paul Stevens, Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer?
That's correct. Yes, that's the lineup. And there's one of the conservative five was sort of out on his own, Justice Thomas, who even would strike down laws requiring disclosure of who pays for these kinds of ads. The majority, Kennedy and Scalia, Roberts, and Alito, as well as all four of the dissenters, were at least on board with upholding disclosure. But yes, that's the lineup. And as you say, I mean, when a case has been argued, and at the end of the term you get an order saying, "Gee, we're thinking about deciding this case in favor of Citizens United on even broader grounds than anyone argued." Nobody took that as a particularly positive sign.
if you weren't in a corporate boardroom.
Right. I should say nobody on our side. except insofar as it suggested that, well, they couldn't see that the narrow grounds advocated by Citizens United were credible. So, you know, we still had some hope that they might stop short of going over the brink of overruling their prior decisions. But, that did prove not to be the case.
Right, they would not. The hope was that they would not be as aggressive as they turned out to be. Let me just read, by the way, a quote from Justice Stevens, who wrote the dissent, and if people recall, he wrote a very powerful dissent to Bush v. Gore in 2000. So Justice Stevens is how old now, Scott Nelson? He's in his late 80s, isn't he?
Yes, 89.
Yeah, I mean, we won't, it makes it all the more important. Let me just share a brief anecdote. I remember in the year 2004, I was just bothering people prior to the election in a movie line and, you know, saying, so are you planning to vote for, you know, this was Bush v. Kerry at that point in the election, and he said, I don't know, you know. I said, well, let me just say two words to you. He was kind of a long-haired guy, and I said, Supreme Court. And he said, you mean we vote for them too? And it just showed me how civics is dead in America. What I'm saying is that, you know, the two judges that Bush appointed, Alito and Roberts, when their appointments and the confirmation hearings were going on, most of the focus, it seemed to me, was on abortion, gun rights, that sort of thing. And yet, if you read their records, both of them had been so solidly pro-business. I don't think I remember reading something like neither one of them had ever, if you will, sided with the underdog.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I could say they never did, but you know, it is certainly the case that we knew that these were conservative justices, and the question was, would they be conservative more in the mold of a Sandra Day O'Connor, who also valued stability and consensus, and on the issue of campaign finance was I would say more the swing voter on the court than Kennedy. Or would they be more in the mold of the more uncompromising justices such as Scalia?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think that in different areas the answer may be different. In the area of campaign finance, we have certainly seen that the big difference was the decision by Justice O'Connor to retire, and her replacement ultimately by Justice Alito.
Yeah, now as I was saying, by the way, that's interesting that you mentioned that conservative, as a Supreme Court justice, does sort of say on big, crucial decisions, consensus is, I mean, it's sort of a conservative value to want consensus on those kind of issues rather than 5-4 splits. I said I would read just a little bit of Justice Stevens's dissent, and then I want to ask about the three questions, corporations as persons, money as speech, and the welfare of the state. Justice Stevens concludes his dissent as followed. At bottom, the court's opinion is thus a rejection of the common sense of the American people, who have recognized a need to prevent corporations from undermining self-government since the founding, and who have fought against the distinctive corrupting potential of corporate electioneering since the days of Theodore Roosevelt. It is a strange time to repudiate that common sense. While American democracy is imperfect, few outside the majority of this court would have thought its flaws included a dearth of corporate money in politics. Scott Nelson, a public citizen, on that issue of corporations as persons, if you would, you know, we've got about 5 minutes to deal with these three issues.
They're complicated.
They are.
You know, corporations, it's really more complicated than just are corporations persons or not, because, you know, for some purposes the law treats a corporation as a person. That's the whole point of having a corporation. It can sue and be sued, enter into contracts in its own name, and it is liable for certain things, but its shareholders are not. But whether it's a person for purposes of the Constitution and what that means is more complicated, especially given that many of the provisions of the Bill of Rights don't actually turn on whether someone is a person or not. The First Amendment does not even include the word person. What it says is Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. And, you know, I think to many of us that suggests that the press might have certain rights, including perhaps or even certainly corporate entities that are part of the press. But beyond that, you know, freedom of speech appears to refer to freedom to exercise a capacity that natural persons have that artificial entities actually may not. And, you know, there are other provisions of the Constitution, such as the Fifth Amendment's self-incrimination clause, that don't apply to corporations, even though they may be persons for purposes of the due process clause, which, you know, provides that you can't hold a corporation liable without giving it a fair trial in the same way that you would give a person who was accused of a crime or of some legal wrong. So, you know, the real question is, do the values of the First Amendment, self-expression, political self-determination, the ability to foster a marketplace of ideas, do they require that inanimate organizations that are put together solely for business purposes be treated as if they were the same as human beings, who are members of our political community, or of the press, which the court has long recognized plays a critical function in informing the public.
Now, of course, by the way, let me just cut in quickly. Nowadays, when the press, let's say with the NBC or MSNBC, is owned by General Electric, or, you know, this sort of thing, it's kind of weird anyway that now that there are conglomerates with many other interests who happen to also be the press. But that's another issue.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that's something that we have to accept. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that the mere fact that newspapers and broadcast entities that engage in news gathering and editorial functions are owned by corporations doesn't necessarily suggest that we just throw up our hands and then say, well, then let's also say that corporations must have an unlimited ability to run ads.
Exactly. Not the only conclusion you can draw from that conundrum.
And, you know, it's sort of interesting that one of the things that one of the moves that is made in Justice Kennedy's opinion is he keeps saying, well, you know, if we don't allow corporations the same rights, you know, that might limit the rights of media corporations and how horrible that would be. Therefore, we must give all corporations
right.
these same abilities to engage in political activities. It's odd that at the same time he holds out the press as something sacrosanct, but then uses the very distinctiveness of the press as a justification for saying we must therefore extend
right.
those same speech rights to all corporations.
And in one minute, Scott Nelson, money is speech.
Well, again, it's more complicated than the slogan either way. Obviously, money is not speech. The question is whether spending for political purposes is speech. And, I guess our view of the matter is we'd prefer not to approach the issue from the question of denying that political expenditures are ever speech, but rather by saying, are there compelling interests that would justify limiting those expenditures when they're made by a corporation? Or if the court has told us that within the current First Amendment we can't do that, should we perhaps change the First Amendment, amend it to bring it back more in line with what we think it was designed to
do? Given this decision in this court, and here I'm going to give you like 20 seconds, is an amendment the most likely remedy?
Well, whether it's likely is one matter, but it certainly would be the most effective remedy at this point, and it would be something that could solve this problem for us, and that's why we're advocating it. But it's a long road.
Yeah, it definitely is. Okay, I really thank you for being with us for this whole hour, Scott Nelson. Scott Nelson is with Public Citizen. Their website is citizen.org. Thank you, Scott, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We also heard from Bob Edgar, president of Common Cause. Their website is commoncause.org. And as I said, there are many other sites, publicintegrity.org, publiccampaign.org, thealliancefordemocracy.org, movetoamend.org, freespeechforpeople.org, and wallstreetwatch.org, which I think have a lot to say on this issue. You can email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want to learn more about that list, or if you want to get my weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about. You can listen to this week's conversation and other interviews at any time during the week by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly either at my website, terrencemcnally.net, that's terrencemcnally.net, or at iTunes. For podcast articles and transcripts, go to that website, terrencemcnally.net, and as I said, the weekly announcement, temcnally@mac.com. I look forward to being with you again next week.